or Fairusa Balk, who, and I'm wearing my Fairusa Balk lipstick today.
Yes.
God, she was just, what a dynamite performance. And, you know, different times that I've watched, because I've seen this movie, you know, 15 times, and there are times where I was just like, oh, Fairusa, you know, dial it in. And then other times I'm just like, no, man, she's game. She's just so willing to like really embody it. And then you watch that with Witches of Eastwick and you see what Jack Nicholson is doing. Like,
yes,
wow. They're both, yes, really keying into the same, you know, I've gone insane kind of vibe. So much witchcraft to learn and reject wholeheartedly from Hollywood movies. Jenny and Trey revisit three of their favorite rites of passage witch movies: The Craft, the original, of course, Witches of Eastwick, and Eve's Bayou. What do these movies get spookily right about witchcraft? And what ends up patriarchal propaganda? The Light and the Fog hosts go full fangirl, dishing the stories, the themes, the hair, and of course, the magic. Spoilers for all these movies.
Alrighty. Well, hello, meow meow.
Cheers, meow meow.
Cheers.
Oh, today we get to do one of our favorite things.
Movies.
Talking movies.
Yes, but not just any movies. We are analyzing witch movies.
Which movies? Witch movies.
movies. Witchy movies. Movies that, as witches, we watch and we just get this special warm, like, this is about us, versus like the, oh, this is how you portray witches. This is gross.
This is wrong.
Yeah.
Yes. And it turns out, I mean, we've talked about this before in previous episodes, that we have a tendency to be drawn to certain media that explains the world to us because we are looking for answers. And I do think that there are... a whole litany of sensitives and psychics and witches who have found a number of these movies because, yeah, they give us some insights.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and I just, you know, there's certain witch movies that just really stick and hold in society. And I feel like ever since we moved away from like being scared of witchcraft, there's a lot that still try and portray it as evil. But I think in particular that there's movies that will portray it as neutral, which is what it is, you know, at the very least neutral, if not good. And we are here to talk about those movies.
Ooh, I love that. And I love that this is the framework, is that we are looking at the good as well as the bad, both in the making, but also in the intention behind the movies and what they, you know, their messages around magic. Because this is, you know, you go to like comic cons and everybody's fighting over which Batman was the best. You hang out with a bunch of sensitive women and it's like, this is what we do. We battle over the craft. And
which member of the craft are we? And I think it's important to note that every single one of these movies on this list has some aspect of witchcraft in a negative light, you know, they portray witchcraft being used negatively, but then a number of these movies also have positive light behind it in some way, or at least they should. So yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, so much to talk about. All right. So do you remember when you first saw The Craft, how it
ended? Yeah, I actually didn't see it until a couple of years ago, where I had my boss, when I was at my HR job, and she was queer and she had vibes about her. And I just told her that I had never seen The Craft and that it was like Halloween 2022. And it was one of my Halloween movies. And she's like, you've never seen The Craft? That's crazy. I never would have guessed that about you. And so then, yeah, I watched it at my house. And I think I've seen it two times since then. And because I was an adult, I vividly remember the experience, you know. I actually bought it on DVD first.
Wow.
And was really, really displeased with the quality.
So of the then DVD. I went and,
yes. And so then I went to Best Buy and I bought the 4K that they had there. And then I was very happy with it. Yeah.
Oh, now you're probably $7.99 in.
At the very least. But yeah, I remember it, you know. It just has like this comforting feel good vibe about it where it's just like a throw it on in the Sunday afternoon while it's raining and I'm coming down from a hangover kind of movie. where there's a lot of like campiness to it, but there's still a lot of reality and a lot of like, oh my gosh, like when they first did their first ritual scene, I don't know, it all just hit because I was into witchcraft at this time, you know? And so I was like, oh, this is one of the rites of passage movies that I have to watch as a witch.
I know. And I'm so conflicted about that because like, I mean, there are pieces and parts that they do get right.
Yes.
But then I always frame things from, you know, it was considered a horror movie when it came out in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And it was made by all men. And, you mm-hmm. know, what's more terrifying to men than teenage girls, apparently, especially teenage girls who are discovering that they have some juice, some juju.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like, you know, and we're really going to get into this when we talk about Witches of Eastwick, but I feel like making a witch movie about witches that is not portraying witchcraft in a fully negative light inherently also has to be a feminist movie. And so, you know, the craft had those hints of feminism coming through, but then at the end of the day, it was still teenage girls fighting amongst themselves, yeah. You know, so it's clearly written by a man.
Mean girls, but with magic.
Yeah, literally. That's literally what the movie is.
So actually Mean Girls is the craft without magic.
Without magic.
Or Farusa Balk, who, and I'm wearing my Farusa Balk lipstick today.
Yes.
God, she was just, what a dynamite performance. And, you know, different times that I've watched, because I've seen this movie, you know, 15 times. And there are times where I was just like, oh, Farusa, you know, dial it in. And then other times I'm just like, no, man, she's game. She's just so willing to like really embody it. And then you watch that with Witches of Eastwick and you see what Jack Nicholson is doing. Like,
yes.
Wow. They're both yes. really keying into the same, you know, I've gone insane kind of vibe.
You know, and stepping off, just talking about it for witchcraft purposes, Farusa Balk's performance, in my opinion, has always hit really hard. And there's the classic scene where she's laughing while the wind's blowing through her hair, you know, and I feel like it just did such a thing to goth culture, you know, and so many goths who I know love this movie for her, even though she's the toxic character of the movie, but like her vibe, her performance, her aesthetic, her distrust of men, and also using her skills against men regularly, even though that was perceived as bad in the movie. It's very like, yes, like stick it to them. Anger, you know, justified anger.
Yeah. She was not just a flat two-dimensional villain. So one of the things I liked about the movie is that we did get to see what her home life was like. And it was horrible. You know, she was being assaulted by her mom's boyfriend, and her mom obviously didn't have any skills or capacity to help save the kid. She, you know, Farusa was in danger at home. So when things twisted, when she used her magic to improve their situation, there's nobody who's upset about that. Oh wait, except she killed the stepdad.
Well, but he sucked.
He deserved it or whatever.
But like that brings up such an interesting point. Cause when you look at, you know, Robin Tunney's character, who's the opposite, who's the came into her powers and is the good witch and has these natural powers that she wants to use for good. She also kind of has a life of privilege. She has parents who appreciate her and love her, you know, and Farusa represents the disruption of that and this disruption of this privilege. And it still plays on these really basic themes of, oh, the traumatized abused kid is going to grow up to be toxic versus the well-adjusted privileged kid is going to grow up to be one of the doctors of the world.
And, you know, blonde like, at will.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love that movie. Yeah. So for folks at home who haven't seen it and maybe aren't gonna, would you give them a rundown of what the
basic is? So I have to refresh my character's name. So there's Sarah, played by Robin Tunney, who moves into this new town with her parents.
Very nice voice.
Yeah. And as soon as she gets there, there's witchy vibes. There's a snake that appears and it's like, oh, what's the snake doing here? You know, and she finds these three other girls who all practice witchcraft, or do they just have vibes? You know, and there's
they're practicing.
Yeah, they are practicing. But I mean, in the beginning, she doesn't know they're witches. There's just the vibes about them, you know, and it's like a meet cute experience between the three of them. And they feel the vibe, so they latch on to her as their potential fourth, which is what they've needed to complete a certain ritual and do more advanced rituals. So over time, they start bringing her in and indoctrinating her a little bit. And they also, all four of them, start to do things to better their lives because suddenly all of their magic is now amplified. You know, she brings in these things, Sarah does, that they didn't know that they could do. Their magic suddenly starts becoming more real than it was before, now that they've had this fourth. And the idea is that Sarah has this natural power that she's bringing into it that the other three may or may not have.
Yes, so two pieces in there that are like if we had sound effects, things they got right. One is when there's an intention to add to your coven, and you have the more people, I'm saying like 20 people, but like for them, it was that fourth. It did amplify everything. And then the other thing that I felt like they got, you know, some people are just naturally already there with their skills and their, well, not skills, but their natural connection to the power. And you're right, it is kind of this weird privilege thing with Robin, you know. And she doesn't want it. And her mom is dead, though. I do need to note that the mom did die. And it turns out, you know, she walks into like a witchy store, a metaphysical store, and right away the woman comes over. She's like, "Oh, you just have all the powers. And your mother was a witch, and this, that, the other, and don't we all want that? Like, seriously, like, you know, I'm a teenage girl watching that, and I was like, where is my person coming up and telling me like how gifted?
Right, trying to find the closest metaphysical store to just run into it and see if they say anything to
All they said to me was like, will that be all?
you. Which I think you're bringing up an interesting point because there's so many things about this movie that hit. And then there's so many things about this movie that are the complete opposite. You know, like for me, the first ritual that they do together, the four of them, where they have the photos of the people, and she has the photos of her beau, you know, and then they're drinking the wine and saying the enchantment and asking for this help from this deity as they're drinking this wine, that hit. Because that's very much how your first ritual feels, where you're just doing it. You know, you're just sitting with a bunch of friends, drinking whatever, and just saying whatever. And then immediately after that, it goes into the fantasy of these horrible, horrible things happening to these people, which I think there's an inkling of truth, but the way they did it definitely felt exploitative, you know, exploitative of witchcraft. You know, and same with going into the metaphysical shop and having, oh, the healer, the witch lady who is of a different dimension is definitely not white, you know, and she says
And
that,
has an
oh,
accent, in case we
yes,
missed that.
always has an accent, you know, and says that you have these power, like what a trope, like
What a dude.
what a cliche. And it's like it sometimes happens like that, but not really, you know, like you go into a metaphysical shop and you just say what you need and they're like, oh, okay, maybe this will help you, you know, and that's really
Yep,
it.
that's really too bad. One of the interesting things about this movie is it was made at a time when there were still lots and lots of mentors for young people in movies. And the older, I don't know if she had been built out more in previous drafts, but she helped a little, but not a
She was
ton.
barely a character.
These folks were really on their own, which can be a feeling, you know, when you start getting swept up into and things are happening and you're trying to organize and categorize and you don't have guidance, it can really feel overwhelming. Yeah, I like that she was at least out there, that there we knew that there was at least one person out there who had enough juice to like combat Firouza Balk.
Well, and it's important to note that Firouza Balk's character isn't bad in the beginning or perceived bad, and that she undergoes this transformation, if you will, especially after they get connected to whatever, I can't remember what deity it was in the film.
Started with an M, but I don't remember.
But after they get connected, which is another scene that hits when they call the corners, because that's something that you and I have talked about previously, or calling in these outside forces and spirits. You know, it's clear that the writers at least did research on witchcraft when they were making this movie about witchcraft.
They did. They had the circle, and they had the pentagram, and they had the candles, and they were showing like the different crystals. You know, like there was a shrine. We had talked about a shrine in one of our episodes, and sure enough, all of the components, well, at least some of the components, were there. I want to talk about the spells that they cast.
Yes, please.
All right. So, Firuza, if I remember correctly, it was really about having power because she felt so powerless. Mm-hmm. And you're right. She was just, you know, a kid who was not safe, did not have good support at home, and could any minute be so damaged and taken advantage of that she could have been broken that way. And witchcraft for her was a way to connect, not just to, you know, some community. She felt safe with her girlfriends, but to also create a path to the kind of power where nobody could ever touch her again. And we already talked about what she did with her power. She mm-hmm. she gave her first. She did the, oh, this is in like every witch movie where it's like stop and all the lights like, oh, gotta have that.
Yeah.
You know, and ends up in the electrical charge, like stops the evil stepfather's heart. But then on top of that, the you know, she invited in the deity, and she not only got rid of the villain, the true villain, but they also ended up getting a bunch of money because the guy had an insurance policy. So like she mm-hmm. literally fixed everything about her life. Now we all as adults were looking at that and being like, well, mom is still a problem and you're still needing therapy, Nancy.
Yeah. For real.
But at least she moved somewhere, you know, where she felt good. And so all of this, like, you know, the manifestation really came in at a super, super charged level. Nev Campbell, you know, of Scream fame. At mm-hmm. this point, she hadn't done Scream. She was Party of Five. And she was kind of a good girl on Party of Five at this point. So she was looking to kind of break out.
Hadn't done One Tree Hill yet.
I don't know if she was on One Tree Hill. I think Party of Five was her jam. Gosh, I don't remember. Anyways, so she had all these scars on her back and was, you know, very, very, very self-conscious, and they greased up her hair. So like this gorgeous girl, of course, like, yeah, make her hair dirty and nobody will see how gorgeous she is because it's the 90s. And that works.
I remember that. You're right. Oh, so, she was the one who had the skin thing as well, right?
Yeah, the scars all over her back. It was getting this really painful treatment. So her wish was to get rid of the scars. And sure enough, they just peel off in this really terrible prosthetic effect. And afterwards, when she comes in, she's like, hey, boys. And it's so interesting to me because nobody could see her back. So it was all in her head, right? That she mm-hmm. was this horrible creature. So that I feel like was playing nicely into the teenage girl thing where they don't see, you know, they don't see what they really look like. They don't see their true value. They kind of beat up on themselves a lot. And I'm not saying she wasn't bullied, but there was really no reason for her to be quite as paralyzed by the scars on her back as she was, but you know, movies. And then she got boys.
Then she got boys. Well, and then, you know, you have, oh my gosh, going back to the page.
Rachel True.
Yeah. And, you know, she had the stereotypical of, I just want the local fascist to be off my back. You know, stop having this horrible privileged white girl to be racist to me, which it's like, all right, true. But like at the same time, really, you know.
Yeah. And it ended up being like a hair thing. So she mm-hmm. she made the girl's hair fall out, which I don't know. I feel like that really lacks imagination. But whatever.
I agree. And it also, like, of all the things you could have had happen to the racist, that would have been too far, in my opinion. That one wasn't too far, you know, where it's like, oh, that was deserved, you know. And deserved. So it really was hard for me to feel bad for that character and be like, oh, the horror. And it's like, she's just losing her hair.
Yeah. Ooh. And then, of course, we have our sunshine princess, Robin, who has a crush on a boy. So talking again about lack of imagination, like there's nothing wrong with Robin. She wasn't going to wish for her mom to come back or anything. Like there's nothing that she wanted or needed. You know, this group of girls like immediately, you know, took her in as one of her own. So she wasn't really struggling with anything. So they just kind of gave her a Skeet Ulrich type to, you know, like, oh, I want him to like me. And then that like grows. So that's like the big thing, right? Is, and they do get this right in the movie, the idea of, you know, what you do will come back times three. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, a couple of times where they're like pumping the brakes and they're like, if we do this, like, you know, it's going to come back. So explain what the times three thing is, Jenny.
So that's just classic karma, you know, and like it's known well in witchcraft, but I also feel like it plays with the rules of three pretty well, where it's like, oh, what you do isn't just going to echo back on you, it's going to triple, you know, and echo back threefold. And in witchcraft, it's just like, I guess the warning against bad magic, where it's like, if you're going to start doing negative magic, your life is going to change. And it very much felt like this movie played on those themes a lot, especially with Fairuza Balk's character, but just with all of them. But yeah, it's a very classic trope. I don't know, because I don't know history of movies and I haven't watched a lot of older movies, I don't know if this was the first movie to introduce that theory, that idea of having things come back on you three times, particularly in the area of witchcraft.
I think it was.
Yeah, it feels like it would be, just with the time that it came out and everything. But yeah, and you know, there's always the classic, your hand's pointed one way and you got three fingers pointed back at you, you know.
Oh my gosh,
and
that's how the second time in 2 days that I've heard that really, really, really fringe phrase. Apparently I need to pay attention to that right now.
Did you never learn that?
Well, sure, but it's just weird that two people in 2 days said exactly the same thing. There's three fingers pointing back.
That's how I first learned about it, you know, but it was in the sense of blame. You know, where if you're pointing blame on somebody, there's three fingers pointed back at you.
Yeah.
You know, and so then very much carries over to witchcraft as well, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, there's pieces and parts that I feel like they were conscious in some of their decisions.
Yeah.
And then in others, you don't, if you're not really specific about the ask, then what happens can be nothing that you thought it would be. And that was a lot of what this movie is. And I think this goes back to the whole, you know, me laughing about all of these white men sitting down and writing about teenage girls who absolutely positively get what they asked for, but like get it in really extreme ways. And now things are out of control and teenage girls can't be trusted with power because look what they do with it. And then they have to rein each other in, and which leads us to, you know, all of the, we have a circle, we have the spell casting. At some point, Robin, the Sunshine Princess one, realizes that Nancy's pretty out of control. Her power's grown exponentially and you can just tell that she's going to be using it for, you know, malicious intent. So she does a binding. So that is a real thing. And they actually showed some of the elements of what can be used in a binding spell. Yes.
Yeah.
And the scary thing there was, well, first off, they didn't explain what a binding spell was. I think she just said, I bind you from harming yourself or others, right? So that's the core of it. But doing a binding spell is not, that's not a good thing to do.
No, I feel like, you know, throughout that entire movie, good or bad, they constantly play with magic that maybe you shouldn't do, you know, like pretty much across the board. There's a couple things there, like calling the corners, depending on why you're calling the corners, I think is okay early witchcraft. But like, yeah, doing binding magic, doing spells to exact harm on other people. A big thing with Firuza's character is she uses her magic to gaslight our main character pretty effectively at certain points.
Yes. Oh, it's psychological warfare. Yeah. Yes. Big time.
Which I liked that aspect, honestly. When her parents were perceived as dead, I was Jenny, like, all right, this was too far. Well, just no, just in terms of the realisticness of it, where it's like, you know, when they seemingly killed our main character's father, I was like, all right, this is now outlandish. But then when it was revealed that was just manipulation, I was like, okay, so we're still staying within the confines of what witchcraft probably could do for the most part. Obviously, they have to draw up the fantasy aspects a little bit with the snakes and the trees and the levitating as well, which I think is really funny that levitating is just such a common theme in both the craft and witches.
Light as a feather, stiff as a board. Light as a feather, stiff as a board. What teenage girl hasn't done that at some sleepover? Yeah. I'm sorry. And what teenage girl hasn't had it work? I know I've seen it work. Yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I've never done it. Well, ooh, I also wasn't a teenage girl when I watched this, but but yeah. So I feel like on the whole, you know, the craft was good. It brought up a lot of really good witchy things for me. And also I consider it to be three that we're talking about, I consider it to be the most problematic.
I agree. So the big problematic thing for me is that Firuza was driven insane by
she magic. Gets locked up at the end,
like,
yes,
epic
I forgot speed. About that. Yeah, I blocked that crap out.
See, exactly, that's what you're supposed to do, because there's something in witches that see persecution and we have to reject that. So this you know, it was entirely the filmmakers being like, careful girls, don't get too powerful, because
you can be witchy but we'll lock you up, be careful,
go blonde but don't go crazy. Yeah, I found that to be utterly terrifying. I found her coming into Robin Tooney's dreams very, very upsetting, because there's nowhere that's safe. You can't get any rest, and it will wear you down. So those two pieces were pretty unnerving. Those were the scariest pieces for me.
I would agree.
And the last piece was what was most problematic for me. I don't know. How about you?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. The last piece being the most problematic. I don't even consider this to be a horror movie. I consider it to be like a fun 80s style thriller, you know, where it's just like, oh, it's fun and it's magic. And yeah, it gets spooky at points, but it's really the psychological elements that F with you a little bit that were problematic or upsetting or frustrating for me. And then also just the fact that all four of these girls come together to do magic, and then it ruins their relationship.
Yeah.
And that none of them stay together. None of them stay friends. In fact, there is this vibe between the three of them that remain at the end that they're enemies almost, you know, and that they have to watch out for each other.
Horrible.
And that was, horrible. That was also frustrating, where it's like, if you do magic with your witchy friends, it's going to ruin your lives. It's going to ruin your relationships. Like, for them still having powers at the end, it's a very anti-magic movie.
It's a very anti-magic movie. Yes, yeah. I agree. So confusing. So there's pieces of it, like we said, that are actually in alignment with like what, you know, like once you start studying, you're like, oh, look, I saw that in that movie. I saw that in the movie. But then, of course, it exaggerates. And then ultimately it shows itself for what it is, which is yet another movie that warns the world against teenage girls, you know, getting too much juice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, Robin was fully herself at the end. She had stepped into her power. She was kind of like Neo at the end of Matrix when he flies up into the air and stuff. It's like, Robin is now amazing. So I do kind of look at it also from the coming of age story for, like, she'll never not be a witch moving forward. You know, Rachel and Nev, they'll probably drift on to the next thing and the next thing. I almost felt like they got lobotomies at the end. They just seemed so silly and dumb at the end.
I agree.
What in the world? Yeah. So, big surprises, not a guide. and not terribly sincere. A couple of good thrills. Like, it's pretty unnerving, but it's not like Rainbow and the Serpent kind of unnerving.
Which I feel like would segue nicely into Witches of Eastwick. Because for me, that's a movie that when you look at the magic, it's a lot more outlandish at certain times. But the theme and the message behind it, I don't know. I actually did some research on this movie because I was very fascinated by it. But I want to hear when you first watched this movie and what impact it had for you.
Oh, man. So I can't remember my life without Witches of Eastwick. so I was that young when I first saw it. Honestly, I probably saw it. They used to rerun movies before there was even cable. You know, like there was like TBS and TNT. And I'm willing to bet that I probably saw it on some outlier cable thing. And you know, I already knew who all of those actors were, and it was just, it was, how do I explain it? I hated Jack Nicholson. I found him creepy. And I couldn't understand why these women would have any interest in this total creeper. And again, this is just me being a kid and understanding Jack Nicholson is not for you, young girl. keep on walking. Give it 20 years and then maybe you'll get all this. I loved the fantastical elements of it. I love that these women just got to go play. I love the cherry sequence. So for those of you who haven't seen it, cherries factor heartily. Heartily in it. It was one of the things that made me start reading John Irving. And I went on a tear and started reading all of John Irving because he kind of works in this space in general. But this is the first time he did Witches. And, you know, when you it will get there. But like the themes of, you know, the purpose of the movie was not witches and the devil. It was, puritanical, the constraints of what happens when people are constrained and decide to rebel against that confinement. And you're saying yes. So is that what you got from it as well?
Yeah, that's what was interesting is I was watching this movie and there's multiple times throughout the movie where it was very clear to me that there was a female on this writing team. You know, there was even that joke that they made about the Bechdel test where they passed the Bechdel test early on. And then one of the characters makes a joke about it. And she's like, we don't even need men. And they're like, huh, why do we end up talking about them so much? And then the scene just ends and you're like, ah, that was so tongue in cheek. It was great.
Now,
and
the Bechdel test didn't exist back then.
I know. But like, it felt like one of those three made a choice and said something about certain lines, because it constantly feels like this movie has this push and pull of, is this a feminist movie? Is it not a feminist movie? You know, where it's like, oh, there's a lot of feminist themes, but then Jack Nicholson's character is just utterly repulsive at times, you know, and these women are still falling for it and they're still being compared to objects by him and then sleeping with him, you know? But I really, really liked how they portrayed the town responding to all of this. And in particular, I was watching this movie for the first time with one of my partners, and there was this polyamorous versus polygamous vibe.
Yes. Ooh, tell me more.
Yeah, which was really interesting because there's times where it's like, oh, this is polyamory, especially with how they all have relations with him. And then suddenly they're all three just together and living together now. And they like kind of just brushed over that and barely talked about it. But now it was a big thing. And then the women are taking the hit of it in the town, being called names like whores and other things like that.
Veronica Cartwright, ladies and gentlemen, she got an Oscar nomination for that role.
Did she really?
She's so good.
So good. And I want to say I respect a movie, especially in the 80s, that is rated R just so that they can have the characters whatever say that whatever the hell they want. Because that's the only reason that movie's rated R. There's nothing bloody about it.
Yeah,
there's nothing scary like there was in The Craft that could have justified an R rating at the time. It truly was just the dialogue and how much characters are swearing and what they're saying. But I liked it because it was, when polyamory is a thing in a community that doesn't accept it, it's a very similar vibe. And also because it was one man and three women, that's technically polygamy, not polyamory. So it was like this constant, like, oh, this is really affirming, and oh, this doesn't feel great at the same time.
You know? Oh, I feel this every time I would watch it at different points in my life. I'd be like, oh my God, okay. I mean, we could do an hour on the wardrobe alone, because sometimes yes. it was so like male gaze gross, but then it was also like Cher in some overalls, and you can't be yes. upset about that. That was her no. version of feeling good about herself, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. And you know, and then like the ridiculousness of, oh, you just need to laugh in order to levitate, combined with like the groundedness of the cherries and the spitting and that ritual, you know, where it's like, okay, maybe if you were to do cherry pits, it wouldn't make someone vomit, but I feel like you could, that there's something there, you know, yeah. that feels like something you could do.
Yeah.
Versus just the laughing and the levitating. I guess we should catch audiences up for those who don't know. The whole,
I think this polyamory or polygamy kind of nails it, but
nails it. I also like this idea because the movie begins with three women who don't think that they have witchy powers. You know, unlike The Craft, where it's like being indoctrinated into this, the witches of Eastwick is they just come into it. You know, where they're like, oh, they come into these abilities to summon things and to call things into their life rather naturally. And I really liked that because that's how it is. You know, you just kind of figure out you can do these things.
Like they all three were master manifestors, to use mm-hmm. modern terminology around it. So Cher was a sculptress, and she mm-hmm. made fertility goddess statues. Mm-hmm. Michelle
Susan Sarandon. Susan Sarandon was a music player, and she played the cello.
Yes, and very uptight, and did her like Susan. By the yeah. way, Susan was the woman to go to for these roles, where she yes. was this, like willing man. Like mm-hmm. I've seen her breasts more than I've seen my own. Like she was just really willing to do that. So she had like the bun and the librarian shtick going on, and like watching her transformation. So she was the artist, but uptight. And then Michelle Pfeiffer was the poor widow who had, she was fertile. That was her manifest face.
So many freaking children. So many children. And they just pop up. You forget how many children she has.
At the hospital, then, I was like, holy crap, there's like a dozen of them.
Yes, I remember who I was with turned to me and was like, that is too many children to have.
And she's too young for that. I'm sorry. Yes. But what was really... you know, part of the key setup of this idea that they had all settled for these lives, and they weren't bad lives, you guys. You know, mm-hmm. Cher's kid was almost a teenager, you know, and she had her own business, and, you know, Susan actually made a living, you know, as a musician, librarian, musician. I don't know. Michelle Pfeiffer was a journalist, you know, so mm-hmm. they were independent women. None of them had men. They were all a little
more successful.
Yeah, they were successful, yes. but like limited success, right? Like none of them yeah. were rich, but they were getting by, and they had each other, and they had these great margarita parties. And I was like, oh my God, now that, you know, I've gotten to the adulthood thing, I'm like, that's a perfectly good life that these women have lived.
I would agree.
But as it turns out, the three of them, when they are together, amplifies.
Well, and it's interesting because I feel like that's where the male writing came through for me is, when they show this life that they're living, and then they imply that some of them are unhappy about it.
Yeah.
You know,
that they needed a man.
Yeah, that they needed a man or something, that they needed to have some come in. And it's like, all right, eye roll, you know. And then we get Jack Nicholson's intro scene, which I loved the penis size jokes throughout. Those were really good for me. They really hit, especially when they do his wax doll later. And he has the little
the giant phallus. Giant so funny. Yes. So again, it's kind of a casual thing where they do a spell, but they don't know they're doing a spell. Also, mm-hmm. they're loaded. Witchcraft is not a thing that one does when one is imbibing, and they all put out the things that they want. And you know, and who cares what it is, but it's, you know, it's a pretty banal list. And we cross cut with this car coming to town. So we understand that they have summoned something. And it's so interesting to me that instead of just manifesting the things that they asked for, how'd the devil get involved? Like, what?
Yeah, for real. Well, and it's interesting because they never specifically call him the devil in the yeah. movie. You know, they do a couple times.
Just your average horny little devil.
Mm-hmm. The person, yes, that was great. the person who I was with referred to him as a demon, you know, and was like, no, don't sleep with the demon. And was like, this is such just a classic tale of witches falling for a demon and it not going well, you know. But yeah, I agree that he's definitely meant to be the devil. Yeah. Although my interpretation of that was a little bit different.
Do tell.
I when the person I was with, and I'm keeping it nameless just because, when they said the demon, I liked the idea of them being a demon, not necessarily the devil, but a demon themselves. Because I know there's a lot of people who have different relationships with Satan, especially with him being a deity that is in practice throughout different cultures. And so I like this idea of this being a deity who is just mischievous and evil and doesn't care and just wants attention and wants love, you know, and found this opportunity with these three witches to come in and do that.
Fascinating.
You know, and to take advantage. And that's a little more.
Yeah. That's a Gen Z read.
Yes.
Because let me tell you, Gen Xers, we didn't know nothing about no demons. We just knew the devil. And oh no, how dare you? You know, you practice magic unwittingly and this is now your punishment. And of course, it turns out to not be a punishment. So there's the saying in when I teach storytelling, you know, to writers is give your characters what they need, not what they want. So they thought what they wanted was a man, this man, this specific man, which he was happy to play whatever role. But in the end, like the man was never the point. It was them manifesting this amazing life. You know, they're living in this huge castle, you know, they've got kids, but the point wasn't to have kids. It was for him. But like, who cares that they had kids, whatever. But they all got to live together and take care of each other and do the thing that men are so terrified that women do, which is to not need them and to just go ahead and step into those roles for each other.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, like if you take the fact that they all get pregnant and have kids out of it for just a second, the arc of that movie is women falling for a man and then coming together to form a coven. You know, that's really it, you know, and then they have this covenant in this nice house at the end. And he's still there, but he's not allowed, you know, and he's kept to the outskirts, but he still exists, which I know we're drooling this really all over the place. End took me completely off guard.
Special effects or the TV stuff?
The giant CGI, man.
It's horrible. It does not age well. Dude, it was 87. It was the best that they could possibly muster.
I felt very similar to that movie, how I felt about 10 Cloverfield Lane, where I'm like, oh, this movie's really fantastic up until the end. And then right after the end, it's really fantastic again.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that the filmmakers, they've done a million interviews about that specific ending. And at some point, like you get far enough down the road away from it that you simply are able to detach and just be like, okay, that campy piece of, Clash of the Titans crapola was, you know, you just let it go, right? There's no suspension of disbelief. You just accept that there's this crappy effect and oh well.
Yeah. You just gotta let it go. Yeah.
It was not scary. It was stupid.
No, it was stupid.
Even when I was a little kid, I was like, that's stupid. I was more afraid of him when he was fighting through their magic because they're trying to get rid of him. They realize what they've done. They've realized that they absolutely positively have manifested evil into their lives. They got to get rid of it. And there's that great scene where they're like sending him to town to go shopping for them because they're pregnant and they have cravings. And the minute he's out of eyeshot, they like snap into it. And it's exactly how women are. It's like, okay, time to get to work, time to get busy. And then that whole sequence just dazzles me as they're figuring out what to do to get rid of him. There's a banishment. And then
they make a voodoo doll at one point, or not a voodoo doll, but like, you know.
What do they call that? There's a word for it. A totem? No, not a totem.
I don't remember what it's called.
I can't remember it.
But I liked the way they did it too, where I've never seen a process like that where they're lighting things of him on fire next to the pot that they're boiling the candle wax with. And I was like, ooh, that's really clever. Like, you know, I know that's dark magic that I don't want to touch. And also I was like, I kind of want to try that now. But like,
and
you know,
like Hollywood, did you not know what you were doing, folks? Well, you know, it was John Updike writing about it. Yeah, so then there's like the, you know, there's the feathers and the wind, and he goes into the church, and I think that's the only time where I was like, well, this can't be the devil, because like the devil can't hang out in a church. Yeah. But he has that amazing speech, and we realized that none of this was about witchcraft at all. It was just a new exploration of gender wars, where he's upset that women won't just do what he wants them to do. And what do they want anyway? And it's an affliction. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, the women are like, oh, you meant for us just to be like sex slaves and baby makers for you? And just to like, you know, I mean, yeah, it would have been a fun life of not thinking about anything seriously, but like, that's not our jam.
I really loved that monologue at the end, especially because when he first meets Cher's character, he is like talking about progressive ideas and talking about pedestalizing women because he thinks that's what Cher wants to hear, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then to have that veil get pulled back at the end where he just says all these awful things. It's like, I know men like this who pretend that they are allies and pretend that they see women as better and different. And then they're just the same, you know, where it's nope.
Just another game. Yeah. So highly recommended, you guys. I mean, I understand that there's like a lot of, there's pieces and parts in there where it's like, you know, magic is bad, but then it's in self-defense or something. I don't even know what ultimately their opinion of magic was. I think in the end, it was mostly just a vehicle for women stepping into their own power. And the things that happen when women, you know, shirk off social conventions, mm-hmm. and worse, they don't care. Because let's face it, Christianity and there's tons and tons of churches in this town. And this is the thing that's keeping all those women like in line, is that they have all decided to be as conventional and married as possible. You know,
and it's funny, I just want to take a moment to talk about Richard Jenkins. I love Richard Jenkins so much. He got typecast so freaking hard after this movie because all he ever plays is the distraught husband or the concerned dad, where he's like, I don't know what's going on. Like, you're crazy. And he's just up in arms and so exhausted. And like, that was his role in this movie. And he got typecast really hard after this movie for the rest of his life.
I just watched Olive Kittredge again, which is only like five or so years old, and it's the exact same role, you know. He was just really good at it. The
exact same role. So
sorry, Richard, but you got lots of awards for it, and you have our adoration. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so lots of religious themes, lots of feminist themes, but also creepy and weird because like he's getting sex, like. Mm-hmm. But they're getting sex too. So it's a very sex positive movie, but at the same time, it's made by a bunch of white men who then punish the women for all the sex that they get. And, you know, so it kind of, is it an intelligent discourse about these themes, or was it just confused? I don't know.
And that's why I had the theory about one of the three of them being on the writer's team, is because I honestly felt like there was this tug in the writing where even the movie itself didn't know what it was saying, you know, until it got to the end where they're all together and they didn't say if, I think they kept practicing witchcraft at the end.
Yeah.
They kind of glossed over that a little bit, but it just felt like a constant, like, this is pro-feminism, this is not pro-feminism the entire time, versus the craft where it was very clearly written by men who are out of touch. This had moments of you're like, oh, but wait a minute, I haven't heard that from an 80s movie before.
As a young female seeking a path towards something that, because I already knew when I was very young, I wasn't going to have kids, you know, marriage, mm-hmm. I don't know, but like, I'm not going to be a conventional person. So it was meaningful to me because it demonstrated women who did get to live outside of social constructs. But again, do I have to like date the devil to get there?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Nice. All right. So the last movie that we are going to pull apart a bit is, oh my gosh, Eve's Bayou.
This is, I don't know. I watched this for the first time a couple years ago. I've actually only watched it once, but it is so etched in my brain. I rented it from the library and they just happened to have a crappy Criterion copy of it that was Blu-ray, where they had taken the original case and then put it in a normal Blu-ray case with the printed cover. And I read reviews and read that had magic elements in it. And a lot of the reviews talked about the voodoo elements. And so I went in not expecting there to be much. And in my opinion, of the three movies, this is the most down to earth.
So
this
great.
This is the most realistic. This is the movie that feels like it was written by a witch, you know, where it's like, you know, there's magic elements that are real, that are in or that are in the reality. They never question them. Mm-hmm. They allow you to form your own opinion of them. And it still ends up being a movie about trauma more than anything else.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm like, ugh, I'm even getting goosebumps now. Eve's bio is so good.
Yeah. So let's set this one up properly.
Yeah.
So this was the first time I was introduced to Cassie Lemons, who is the writer director. So she was one of the few Black women who got an opportunity to make their own movie. Mm-hmm. And this is what, you know, what she brought forward. So it is a Black cast, and oh, what a cast it is.
So amazing. Those child actors were unbelievable.
And she still works. The Jeanette's, is that her name? Smollett? I see her all the time.
Oh, Journey Smollett.
Journey, there it is. Thank you. She still works. The other girl, I just saw her in something, the older sister. Can't remember what it was, but yeah. Okay, so they are in the Bayou, so Louisiana, which is also territory for Hoondoon or voodoo or whatever you call it. There is epigenetics like crazy. It is based in what year do you remember or get a feel for it? Like I'm 40s maybe?
60s, 1960s.
Oh God, okay. So 1960s. Sam Jackson is oh man, this is one of the few times where he just gets to play his charming
song. Yeah, he doesn't scream at any point in the movie.
and he loves his daughters and his son. Mm-hmm. He is such a good parental or father role model. He's got the hottest wife on the planet, Lynn Whitfield. And he's got a problem. He must be a sexaholic because apparently he's banging everybody all the time.
Everybody.
And he's out there making use of, I don't know, his charms, something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just getting around town. Then we have the aunt. I believe it's the aunt, right?
Debbie Morgan.
Yes. Okay. And go ahead.
She's young and the restless. She used to win awards constantly for being on that soap opera. She is amazing. And she never got to have a feature career. And Cassie brought her over. And it just, I was like, yay, maybe now, Debbie. And not really, but it certainly expanded.
Well, and she was just one of the defining characters for me besides the two daughters, where she constantly, because what she did was, essentially she was a medium, you know,
she was a prophet, and
you know, she would do the service for the town, but the way that it was done, it felt very home knit, you know, and it felt close community, like people trusted her and trusted what she brought forth, and that's why it worked, you know. And the way that this movie talks about her magic, it tells you what other characters think of it, but it never tells you what to think of it. Unlike The Craft, unlike Witches of Eastwick, it's very much, here's this practice that this lady does. It is grounded in her reality. You can decide how real it is for you or not. We are going to tell you how real it is for these characters.
Yes.
You know, and I do think we arrive at a conclusion by the end of the film, but throughout the film, it's constantly just allowing you to sit in this environment and absorb it. And she really is just such an influential witch character for me because of that, because it's not bogged down by opinions or beliefs. It is a person who just gets to be a witch person.
Yeah.
You know,
and so I love that they, Cassie did the research. Like, this is how a lot of women made a living, starting back in Victoria times, post Civil War, where you went to somebody's house and they read your bones or they read the cards or whatever, you know, their thing was. She just needed to have physical contact, you know, and she could see, you know, details about that person's future. So historically, it was correct. And it wasn't glamorized and it wasn't romanticized. Oh, and by the way, no, she's cursed. Like, she doesn't get to have love in her life because all the men she loves dies.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes. So there was there a price to pay for her magic? They never really conclusively tied those two things together, but she cursed.
And I like that, you know, obviously of the three movies that we're talking about today, this is the female held one. Yeah. This is led by females. This is directed and written by females. So when it talks about the curse that she has with her exes, they don't put the onus on her. They actually put it on the men, you know, which I really liked, and that it was the men's insecurities and that it was these other things that were cropping up. And it's like, so refreshing to have this kind of content written by a woman, because, you know, if it had been written by a man, they would have put the onus on her a little bit, that it was because she was practicing witchcraft, or is because that she's different, you know, and these men couldn't cope with it. But no, not at all. And that was really, you know, it made her feel human and feel relatable and not necessarily just a girl with magic or a woman with magic.
Yeah. I mean, she was a complex person. I do want to mention that she was an adulterer, and the curse came out of her committing adultery. But it wasn't the same Sam Jackson adultery where he was just banging to bang. She fell in love. And is that better? I don't know. I'm not judging. But after that, it was, you know, she felt like she was never going to have love in her life again because she did step out of that moral box.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up the fact that Sam Jackson's character was an adulterer, and the fact that he still has punishment for that is really nice as well. Granted, it's very bittersweet, and that wasn't the reason behind it, but it was at the same time.
It was.
Yeah.
The same thing that happened to his sister's husband and lover is the exact same thing that happened to him. So then you think, oh, is it a family curse? You know, that you commit adultery and then the cuckold husband pulls a gun.
Mm-hmm. But then that's on the backdrop of childhood trauma and something happening in your childhood that changed everything for you. Yeah. And I feel like, especially because the subject in particular of this is assault and it's violation from an authority figure and from a parent, I feel like the way that Cassie handled this was beautiful, just beautiful, very considerate, very touching. The fact that Sam Jackson's character was a nice person who loved his daughters, and also we as the audience believed that he is somebody who might actually be capable of this the entire movie, regardless of if he did or didn't do it, which we don't ever find out in the movie. The fact that we know that he could be capable of it is all that mattered.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the fact that all of the women, because this is, you know, Sam's the only dude in the family. It's all women. And there was not a moment's hesitation that when they found out that he had betrayed this trust and assaulted his daughter, they were out the door. And there was consequences. They didn't pretend like everything was going to be fine. I mean, it absolutely destroyed the wife. It broke her heart. But she wasn't taking it out on the kids. You know, the daughter, you know, she left out of shame. But later on, we find out there's a different reason for that shame. But she leaves the family. And then, the most heartbreaking thing of all, the daughter, you know, who had the biggest daddy issues, like she wanted to be the favorite, finds out that this happens to her sister. And she and she hires a hit, a magical hit. What?
Yeah, which I really love, you know. With the craft, we play with this idea of karma coming back to you, you know, and that when you seek something out, it comes back to you. The way that they do it in Eve's bio, I feel like, is the most realistic, you know, where she asks for this magical hit to happen, and it does.
It's horrible.
Yes. And the consequences she has to deal with it aren't her getting murdered herself.
Yeah.
It's internal. It's trauma. You know, it's growth.
It's pain. Not empowerment for her to take this guy out. It destroys her.
Yeah, it ruins her. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we come back to the final scene at the very end of the movie where they reconnect and we find
out. Meaning the two sisters.
And we find out that the older sister, she doesn't actually fully remember what did happen, you know? And I think what's powerful for me in that is it doesn't erase anything that happened. It leaves it with the audience, you know, of like, okay, what do you think happened? How do you feel in your heart? You know, especially with how trauma is, especially knowing what we know about trauma and memory behind trauma. Mm-hmm. And that amazing voiceover line at the end about memory that's from the beginning of the film.
It's yes. Yes. And so it turns beautiful. Out, once again, magic is just the background, man. It's just mm-hmm. an element in life. And these things were going to happen anyway. You know, regardless of the prophecy powers in the family, because it turns out Journey, who is, I think, 10 in this movie, you know, it turns out that she does have the power as well, but that wasn't the point. It was, is it a blessing? Is it a curse? Oh gosh, it's going to be both for this poor girl moving forward, you know, and I want to go back to the trauma piece. You said it so well. So the daughter had said that the dad had assaulted her. Everybody, you know, kicks him out. He is shunned. Then Journey does the magical hit, but then changes her mind. She doesn't want it. And Sam still, and we're spoilers, folks, total spoilers. So Sam still dies, but did he die because of the hit or because he was sleeping with another man's wife and it had already been established that you were pretty much allowed to kill the guy who was sleeping with your wife in this society. And that's what happened. So he did it to himself, but mm-hmm. here's Journey, who's like, no, I did this. We don't know. And then she finds the letter from Sam, who explains, you know, and very eloquently and convincingly, this is what happened and I'll never forgive myself. You know, she came on to me and I was pushing her off of me and in her shame, whatever. Right. So, you know, again, it's this whole idea of men like reframing it and we don't know whether to believe him or not. I mean, it's Sam Jackson. Yeah. Like you want to believe him. But you can't. So my read at the end was that both of these girls were never going to talk about it again. It was mm-hmm. possible that Journey killed their dad. It was possible that Journey killed their dad because the daughter lied. We don't know. But these two sisters are bonded in this trauma. And it's horrible as it sounds, like they will be each other's protectors.
Yeah. Well, and the way it ends is they heal as best as they can, and also they have to carry this for the rest of their life.
For
me, this feels like a feminist movie because this is told from somebody who appreciates what being a victim is actually like, you know, and what this world makes you feel like. And the fact that we never get an answer as to what Sam Jackson did or didn't do, the fact that we don't find out who was right, you know, the fact that it is on us if we believe that the magical hit worked or not. But what matters is Journey believed it worked. Journey believes that it was her who did this thing. It's just, it's so, you know, you spend your whole life watching movies made by men, and then you watch a movie made by women that's not like a non-white movie made by women, and you're just like, wow, so many things I was missing that I had no idea, you know.
What a beautiful way to say it. Yeah.
And I want to talk for a second about like the fact that this was a non-white movie. I also feel like contributed to the portrayal of magic, because mm-hmm. I feel like as a white person, white culture was so against this kind of stuff and fought against it so hard and went into the puritanical Christian side of things. But like other cultures, magic still exists very vividly for them because they've allowed it to exist in their family, because they've believed in it, you know? And that was very much the vibe of this movie, where there was a lot of people of this town who believed in these magical powers, mm-hmm. who understood them, who accepted them, you know? And then there was a couple that didn't, of course, but like, that wasn't the point of it. It wasn't about the magic, like you said. So the magic was allowed to exist.
The fabric of their lives happened to include prophecy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, so gorgeous. And Diane Carroll. Oh, she's so good. Who's, you know, a legend. She's, I believe she's one of the first Black women to ever start winning awards. I think it was a Tony first. I'm not exactly sure. She's one of the first Black women that white people had on their radar because of Dynasty. She got cast on Dynasty, for goodness sakes. And then also Cassie's husband, Vondi Curtis Hall, that I cannot remember a time that I haven't had a crush on him. So he's the guy that comes in and shows the aunt, the cursed aunt, that no, you can break the curse.
Yeah. So
the magic doesn't have to own you. Which is another really huge lesson, which also means the trauma doesn't have to own you. It gives me goosebumps. Yeah. We love this movie. Thanks for bringing up Eve's Bayou, because I haven't seen it since it came out. It was wonderful to go back to it.
And it was such a wonderful Criterion pick, because with Criterion movies, sometimes I'll find one that has vibes and then just send it, you know, if I can get it for free or rent it and say, heck it, it's a Criterion, so it's probably going to be decent at least. Eve's Bayou just blew me away. You know, you start it and it feels like this made for television movie almost, you know, like where it has just this,
it's low budget.
Yes, low budget, easy vibes, and like it takes its time with the family drama, you know, it takes its time setting up all the characters. You can vividly picture it with commercial breaks. But by the end of it, you just get so enwrapped in it, and then it's just truly one of the most unforgettable final scenes that I've ever seen in a movie.
Agreed.
Where you're just like,
Yeah.
Thanks for talking with me about these movies today, Trey.
Thank you, and I'm so glad that you had the idea for this episode. I am always down to have the movie conversations. So thank you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Meow, meow.